Okay, hi everybody. Can everybody hear me okay? Thank you. Welcome to LSE for this public event. My name is Dr. Millie Lake. I'm an Associate Professor of International Relations here at LSE. I am absolutely delighted to be here to celebrate the launch of Dr. Kate Miller's new book, Support the Troops, Military Obligation, Gender, and the Making of Political Community. On a personal note, I just want to really quickly say before we begin what a pleasure it is to be here to launch this really remarkable book. There's a copy here and we'll show you a QR code at the end that you can click on to order it for yourselves if you would like a copy, which hopefully this conversation will inspire you to do. I was really fortunate enough to have Kate be one of the very first people I met when I arrived at LSE, and she's been a friend and a mentor and an intellectual inspiration to me ever since. So it's a real privilege to share this conversation with her and to think through some of the really amazing and powerful ideas that she explores in the book. So thank you, Kate, for sharing. I'm also really delighted to be joined by these other esteemed panelists, scholars, and academic inspirations that I have sitting next to me. I couldn't think of a more exciting panel to, again, share this conversation with. So thank you, everybody, for being here. I'll let the panelists introduce themselves briefly, but I'll just say a couple of words about each. So I have Professor Kimberly Hutchins here to my left, who's a professor in the School of Politics and International Relations at Queen Mary, University of London. Her research interests cut across the conventional distinctions between politics and IR, and she's interested in the ideas and assumptions that structure and influence political and ethical judgment and action. So we're really excited for her reflections on the book. Dr. Maria Rashid is an LSE fellow in the Department of Gender Studies here at LSE. Her research explores service and death in the Pakistani military and situates militarism as a set of gendered governing practices that not only control effective selves, but also produce them. Thank you, Maria, for joining. And finally, Dr. Chris Rossdale is a lecturer in the School of Sociology, Politics, and International Studies at Bristol University. His research sits at the intersection between international relations theory and the study of resistance, looking at the ways in which our understandings of international politics shift when we begin from the perspective of radical social movements. So I will let the panelists further introduce themselves when we begin. I'm going to turn to Kate now for about 10 minutes, and then we'll hear from all of the speakers in turn. And at that point, we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. So please save your questions and comments until then. And thank you, Kate. I'll let you go ahead.
Thank you very much, Millie. Am I audible via assistant?
Maybe move, just
maybe
put it up.
Okay. Oh, there we go.
Yeah, that's
yeah, I'm just checking. I think that's better now. Thank you. So, yes, thanks again, Millie, and thanks so much. I'm going to thank you again later, but thank you so much, Chris, Maria, and Kim, for agreeing to participate in the event, to read the book at such a very, very busy time of year to be taking on that type of academic labor. I'm so thrilled to have such esteemed colleagues, mentors, and inspirations here to discuss my work. Each of them has written at least one book that I thought, wow, I really, really wish I had written that. It is so amazing. And it's a real pleasure to be able to speak with you today. So to frame our discussion, for those of you who haven't yet, let's assume, read the book, I'm going to go over really quickly some of its key interventions. So, like a lot of IR scholars of my generation, my research was really highly informed by being a young person at the time of the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And what struck, actually, a lot of things struck me, of course, at that time, but specifically what struck me and what stuck with me and informed the way the book is set up was this. Obviously, we know now the wars in Afghanistan, particularly Iraq, were highly contested from the start and became relatively quickly broadly unpopular. At the same time, citizens routinely reported thanking serving military personnel for their service. This was incredibly common. Surveys in the US and UK suggest this is up to 90% of people surveyed. This means that some relatively substantial portion of people, somewhere between maybe 30-50%, it's very difficult to estimate based on contemporaneous surveys, routinely thanked people for their military service fighting wars in which those same people were opposed, right? And the thing that really got me at the time, and still I find interesting now, is that fact, people routinely thanked people for serving in wars they opposed, didn't seem particularly odd, right? It was relatively unremarkable. It's unremarkable to many people now. And that sort of generally is what the book addresses, right? Why? How did supporting the troops in wars one opposes become not only normal, not only commonsensical, but also perceived commonly as a matter of morality? And what does that in turn do to how we think about and relate to war and how we think about and relate to politics? So those are kind of the issues the book unpacks, looking at support the troops discourses. Don't worry, I'm not going to talk in too much detail about how I constructed this. In the United States and the United Kingdom during the early years of the so-called global war on terror, right? So from about 2001 to 2010. As sort of a step towards answering those questions, the book offers a premise, right? It flags what I think is a transformation in the normative structure of civil-military relations, and alongside it, really importantly, a challenge to idealized gender roles and assumptions relating to citizenship and citizenship's relationship to violence. Broadly, in our, and I hold the hour, I hope, very, very lightly, but referring sort of very generically to an idea of liberal democracies, Western liberal democracies, and so forth, right? Noting that these are incomplete and insufficient categories always. That in our cultural myths and imaginaries, we tend to imagine that in wartime, all good citizens, right, whom in the past were good men, today are is everyone who might aspire to meet the gendered ideals of normative citizenship, should serve in the military, right? And that broader civilian society should somehow contribute to the war effort. In the book, I call this idea the liberal military contract. You serve, you get rights. This is how the political community hangs together. You are familiar with the romanticization of this idea into a cultural myth about good men, good wars, and so forth, if basically you've ever seen a movie about World War II. Right, you know this idea, this is how this goes. In the present, of course, if you've seen later generations of war movies, as well as the news, you know that in liberal democracies, not all of them, but notably the US and UK, this of course isn't really how war works anymore. Instead, we have distant conflicts fought by much smaller professional armed forces, right? The vast majority of people neither serve in the armed forces, nor do they directly experience the effects of the war, right? They don't participate in the war in sort of a material sense that we might immediately recognize. And this, I argue, produces anxiety about what it means to be a good citizen, and given how tightly tied ideas of soldiering and citizenship are into ideas of masculinity and good public personhood, also produces anxieties about what it means to be a good person, good citizen, good public subject, good man in wartime, absent military service. I refer to this as gendered civilian anxiety. Gendered civilian anxiety arising from the non-service of civilians in wartime and the way that confronts some of our normative expectations about how this, like, big air quotes, should go. And basically, in the book, I argue that we should understand supporting the troops as at least partially a response to this, right? This particular transformation in how the gendering of civil-military relations works, and what this means for normative gender or idealized gender order. It's an attempt to cope with what it means to be good citizen, good man, good masculine subject in wartime. And support the troops discourses through a series of somewhat complex discursive moves that I won't walk you through now, though ask me if you're interested, offer differing visions of normative masculinity, citizenship, and often different ideas of an ideal political community and how it relates to war. Through these complex discourses, I suggest that the broader idea of supporting the troops works to put it overly simplistically, reverse how we typically think about gendered civil military relations, right? And so normally we think about this according to gendered logic of protection, wherein a protective, righteous, and masculinized military protects a dependent and vulnerabilized civil society from enmity, predation, violence, and so forth, right? In the sort of archetypical feminist story, this isn't how it ever actually works, but in the archetypical story, this is how we think it goes. In support the troops discourses, I argue, instead, now civilian supporters protect and support a vulnerable and dependent troops, who in the discourse are not constructed as state agents of violence, as participants in war, but the troops who are instead typically presented as A, very passive, and B, as a result, usually themselves victims of the conflict in which they are purportedly fighting. And that conflict itself is usually presented as, in this interesting way, as a somewhat agentless harm. War is talked about like the weather, like a natural disaster, rather than the outcome of a socially and politically embedded decision-making process. And so on this basis, I argue two things. That support is reconstructed as A, itself a form of military participation, and B, support is in the process of replacing service as the hallmark duty of good citizens and normative masculinity, so idealized manliness, however we think that is, in the context of war. So to put it really bluntly, to give you the title I almost gave the book, support is the new service. And I see from that reaction, this was the right call. So, really importantly though, I also point out in the book is that although support the troops discourses is ostensibly universal, this is like the logic of how this discourse works. The idea is that it's integrative, right? Everyone can and should support the troops regardless of your embodied identity, your political affiliation, your opinion on the war. If you are a member of the community, you are obliged to support the troops, right? This is a fundamental political obligation in relationship to violence. Everybody does do it and must do it, right? Again, not empirically the case, but it's the logic of how this discourse works. Despite that, I point out in the book that the support the troops discourse isn't exempt from pre-existing patterns of coloniality and transnationalized racialized hierarchies. This comes up in a lot of ways, right? But is notable, for instance, in the fact that actual military service of migrant military personnel, so who are not citizens, many of whom are people of color, as well as assistance to US, UK, and coalition and NATO forces by locally employed Afghan and Iraqi civilians, right? Despite the perils posed to people in those positions following the withdrawal of US and UK troops, despite that actual military service, despite that material support to US and UK militaries, that in and of itself is often not sufficient to be granted political membership in the form of citizenship, or often, as unfortunately we've seen really recently in the case of the UK and to some degree the US, even an emergency refugee visa. And so one of the points the book makes is that even though support the troops is and operates like a universalistic integrating discourse, it pertains to everyone, it still rests on, and like lots of liberal ideology to some degree obscures, a continued logic of transnationalized racial military sacrifice. And so supporting the troops, though it is an internally oriented idea, we support the troops to be good people, it's also a continuity of the logics of liberal empire. Within the US and UK, don't worry, I'm wrapping up, I argue that support the troops have, as you probably either experienced or can pretty quickly imagine, some pretty troubling implications for democratic debate about war, as well as anti-war protest and dissent. So the hegemony and normalization of this idea that we must support the troops no matter what creates a situation wherein supporting the troops is seen as the default, as normal, and really importantly, as totally apolitical, which also creates a situation where the obverse, right, where any questions or debates that might be seen as in any way even talking about the troops, let alone impugning them, most importantly being asking questions and debating the wars per se, those types of discourses quickly come to be framed as not only inappropriately political, i.e. doing them is inappropriately political, regardless of what you actually say in the content of discussing the war, but it's also framed as dangerous. Dangerous to the war, dangerous to the troops, and in ways that don't really make sense but come up quite often, somehow themselves dangerous to democracy through an inappropriate politicization of the troops. Obviously, that has a pretty chilling effect on democratic debate during war, and it also makes it really, really difficult for both moderate and radical anti-war and peace protesters to get a fair hearing for a message that contests war per se, particularly if it's not sort of qualified by language you might be familiar with that peace groups have increasingly taken up, which is the idea that you should support the troops by bringing them home. So as a result, the major, it's not the only one, but the major political effect of support the troops discourses is to shift the central ethical and political question of war away from issues of legitimacy, away from the very real harms suffered by civilians in the theaters of conflict, to a more comfortable internal question of whether or not we, right, whoever we are, whether or not we are supporting and caring for the troops correctly. It shifts questions of war from violence perpetuated inside and outside the political community to a question of internally oriented support, solidarity. And so supporting the troops as an idea, as a discourse, as a practice, and also, I should have noted, as a very genuinely heartfelt affect and proclamation that holds a very great deal of meaning to a very great many people, all of that together works to banish both politics and violence from discussions of war. And so, to close that out, before I turn over to my esteemed colleagues for their thoughts, I'll just note that, as I imagine you're aware, we're about 3 days out from the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, right? Which obviously was a central event in the so-called global war on terror, which, to date, the Cost of War Project estimates has killed over 929,000 people in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan. And so my larger point is that for those of you that were familiar with Support the Troops before we started having this conversation, right, though it might look apolitical, it might look harmless, it might look and feel like an obligation, supporting the troops might also look and feel like a kindness. It's also really deeply entangled in the facilitation of liberal war and conduct of violence abroad. And so the point of the book, the upshot of my argument to you now, is that far from being sort of a bumper sticker slogan or like a nice one-off thing we do at the airport or a sports match or a band we might wear, supporting the troops is a deeply, constitutively political practice of military solidarity. And as a result, it bears quite close examination and not some small amount of critical reflection. That's what the book is about. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Kate. So I'll turn over to Chris and we'll just go in the order that you're seated. Thank you.
How's that? Oh. How's that? Cool, great. Yeah, thanks very much. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk of this, Kate. Kate and I were colleagues at the LSE until about 3.5 years ago, and worked together for 3 years here, and spent many, many hours in the cafes around this building debating the minutiae of theories of militarism and martiality in the way that only really geeky academics can kind of, you know, when you find someone who's working on the same stuff as you and you're like, oh, we can go to a really absurd level of kind of ridiculousness on these concepts. And it's a real joy to kind of see that manifest in the book and to spend a bit of time with this like wonderfully, densely incisive and coherent piece of work that is kind of detailed and rigorous in a way that kind of, as if I can call us both sort of fluffy feminist post-structuralists, is a level of detail and rigor that is not always characteristic of the work. And there's a kind of an intensity and incisiveness to really kind of pull apart this discourse in its intricacies and lay it out and show what it does. And it does that carefully and elaborately in a way that is very arresting and pretty difficult to disagree with, much as at times I might have wanted to. No, it's brilliant, and it absolutely does what it sets out to do, which is show the power of this discourse as kind of so intimately constitutive of contemporary liberal orders and contemporary liberal war. The book, as you finish by saying, it shows how kind of questions of complicity and empire are transferred into questions of solidarity at home, how this support the troops discourse conceals the harms of war while kind of awkwardly reproducing the liberal community. And in that you join the chorus of voices showing the role of violence in holding together the liberal social order. And you do that really powerfully. And you finished with it, and it's what I work on. So I was especially struck by the challenge to anti-war politics in the book. You know, you show how central the support the troops discourse is to anti-war politics. You know, those rhetorics of support the troops, bring them home. I think at one point you say that almost half of the incidences of support the troops discourses come from an anti-war perspective. You know, it's such a foundational discourse to attempts to criticize the war in a way that reveals how, reveals the discourse as a kind of condition of intelligible political speech and condition of intelligible dissent. If you want to speak politically, you have to support the troops. And if you don't support the troops, you're not a meaningful part of the political community, you're not a meaningful part of intelligent discourse, you are to be excised. And so anti-war politics faces a trap. You either say we support the troops, at which point you're reproducing a kind of martial order, even if you're criticizing a particular war, or you don't support the troops, at which point that's not real speech, it's grotesquely offensive. And you lay that trap out for anti-war politics, as well as kind of show how different anti-war politics has been skewered on that in a way that is incredibly uncomfortable, but very effective and successful. And part of what that does is show how powerful the support the troops discourse is at kind of eating any opposition to itself. You know, a refusal to support the troops is turned into a sign of the enemy against whom the troops must be supported. And so resistance to it can so easily be reproduced as re-establishing the necessity of supporting the troops in the face of these vile Westboro Baptist Church people or anarchists or whatever. And so it's powerful and unsettling, and you do show that there are ways of kind of subverting or resisting the discourse, but they're tenuous and they're difficult because this is such a foundational political discourse, and the book lays that out wonderfully. And so it becomes, you know, a really important intervention in scholarship on liberalism and war. It's a magnificent example of how to do detailed feminist post-structuralism. And if you're really into the nerdiness of it, it's a powerful blow in the wars over whether and how we should conceptualize militarism. I had a couple of things that I wanted to prod at, which are, I think, implicit in parts of the book, but don't come through quite as much, that I thought you might have some reflections on. One is about the role of desire for the troops. So the support the troops discourse is positioned in the book as a discourse that manages gendered civilian anxiety. You know, the anxiety that we don't serve in the military anymore, but we can kind of play our role in the social contract by supporting the troops, and so kind of restore the kind of the sanctity of the liberal order. And the argument about that is really convincing, but it's an argument about kind of how support the troops kind of fills an absence or a lack or a problem. And I wonder what place is left in that for a kind of a more active and desiring relationship for and with the troops. Like, what is the status of an eroticized or fetishistic relationship with the troops? And that's a relationship that's very present and obvious with soldiers, right? Part of the reproduction of the idea of the soldier is as a kind of sexy, desirable object. As something that is kind of reproduced as hyper-masculine because of our desire for the soldier. And I wonder if that kind of eroticized desire survives the gendered inversion of the shift from soldiers to troops. Like, what happens to desire when we go from the kind of individual soldier to the plural troops? Does it survive? If it doesn't survive, what is being excised or lost with that kind of dropping out of the erotic? And if it does survive, what place does that erotic relationship with the troops have in your analysis? So that's one question. I have another one here. Here it is. Okay, yeah. So erotics is one. And then at the end of the book, you call for a critique and, for a moment, quite thrillingly, the abolition of the military alongside other institutions of state violence. Police forces, border forces, and so forth. You say, look, we need a wholesale critique of state violence, and that has to fold in militaries, but also the other agents of state violence. And it's interesting, but makes sense, that those other institutions of state violence are absent in the book, because they're absent in the support the troops discourse, right? So the support the group's discourse pays no attention to the police as an agent of state violence, because they don't have a foundational role in liberal storytelling. But the idea that those various forms of state violence are separable is part of liberal storytelling, right? Liberalism depends on the notion that there are very different kinds of agent of state violence, and they play different roles in liberal storytelling. That's part of the ideological edifice of liberal violence, I think. And that's why your call at the end of a book for a repoliticization of all violence came through really powerfully. But I guess it made me wonder what role the support the troops discourse plays in relation to other practices of state violence. So are discourses like Blue Lives Matter cousins of support the troops? Like, what is the relationship between the different forms of kind of civilian obligation to and recognition of other agents of state violence, whether it comes in the form of explicit recognition like Blue Lives Matter, or the fact that we feel no imperative to kind of thank the border force? Right, like, what's happening there? And like, how might the kind of practices of refusal you talk about at the end unsettle those distinctions? Yeah, thank you again. It was a joy to read this book over the last few days. Thank you.
Maria.
Thank you. Okay. I just realized while I was sitting here that I didn't bring my glasses and I have notes, but I'm hopefully going to be able to read what I wrote. Okay, thank you. I'll manage. So thank you, Kate, for inviting me to speak here today. And it's a double thank you because, one, of course, I'm just very pleased that I'm here and reading this wonderful book, which really speaks to my own work so closely. So, and secondly, because I think it is, as Chris said, it is a very important book, of very, very pertinent to the times that we live in. And in the space that you're producing it, I think it makes it even more pertinent. And because it really takes this very fuzzy and seemingly benign notion of support the troops and places it very centrally as a site for scrutiny and analysis to understand how citizens of liberal democracies and not just states are invested in and effectively engaged with the idea of war and violence. And I say this from the location of my own work around affective logics that, you know, underpin military service in post-colonies like Pakistan. Because one of my pet peeves when my own book came out was its reception in certain quarters, you know, where it was met with a certain orientalizing kind of logic about how these technologies work in armies of the global south and sort of reducing it to religious beliefs around Islam and jihad. So again, it was just a pleasure to finally, you know, have this in my hand and just somebody, to have somebody so rigorously research and then support this argument in this context. So congratulations and thank you. When you set up support the troop discourse as constitutive of the Western liberal political community and not just as a feature of it, I think you have posed a very deep political challenge to citizens whose moral and material support is given to these troops, right? And troops that, as you say in the book, in addition to making themselves vulnerable to violence, also kill, maim, destroy the other, both the human and the non-human, right? And this, again, as I've said earlier, this challenge is important for all nation states that wage war, but, you know, the challenge is so much more important when in the metropole, in the heart of the empire. So again, thank you. So one of the, when I was reading the book, I think one of the things that stayed with me after is I think you have it really sharpens our understanding of how militarism operates in, within very shifting sort of structural and ideological contexts. And this notion that you bring up, which is this idea of solidaristic martiality, I really sort of thought that was a very productive concept to take forward, partly that you say comes up in response to civilians who are no longer doing military service as a response to, you know, cisgender, white anxiety around, and a desired sort of aspiration to normative ideals of masculinity, and also aspiring to citizenhood, which you bring out. So I think that notion, for me, it sort of takes us forward in terms of how militarism may be operating differently now, as it did compared to how it did earlier. So that was a very productive idea that you put out. And then you, in chapter 7, which I read very closely, because you sort of take it outside the UK and the US, and you talk about other transnational contexts. So what you say about how this solidarity and affection rests not just on the larger politics of war and the externally directed enmity, which is roughly, crudely put, is the politics of hate, but it also is really materialized through internal solidarity that comes from proximity, interdependence, and shared circumstances. For me, it was very interesting to read because in the sense that and I think this, I'm going to quote this from the book. You say support bounds the political, so that to be a member of the political community is by definition to be supporting the troops. And that kind of, it brings out the challenge that you're putting out of, you know, how do you step away from this? Because this is what defines the political community. So, and that was, I think, important. And what particularly resonated with me was how solidaristic martiality extends across Western nations and how these imperial logics are then repackaged in relations between states to produce good political communities transnationally. And I say this because then you go on in that chapter to talk about notions of solidarity and how they function when allies in a war are states that are racially othered. And I think that's for obvious reasons, that was interesting for me from my own context. And you give this example of Turkey in the book. So I just wanted to highlight, and I want to, if you have time at the end, and maybe comment, and we can take this up later, because unlike Turkey's example that you give in the book, where the expectation of support was framed in a mix of strategic and obligatory logics, with Pakistan, the logics oscillated between transactional and strategic, and at times, out and out threat, right? So there's this famous quote from Richard Armitage, who was the foreign policy advisor in Bush's administration in the early days of the war on terror, in which he said to the president of Pakistan, who happened to be a military dictator, that we will bomb you back to the Stone Ages if you don't. So your work makes me wonder if there was any political obligation set up for countries like Pakistan to support coalition troops through an invitation to join the good political community defined by the white imperial, you know, West. And Pakistan lost close to 7,000 troops and up to about 5,000 civilians. And this was in a war that was dubbed as America's war that was, you know, that played out in our own backyard. So between 2001, for example, to 2009, and this is only half the period, Pakistan endured over 200 suicide attacks, 500 bomb explosions, and you know, in various cities of the country. And despite this, till the end, the Pakistani state remained suspect and was constantly viewed as not doing enough. And maybe it wasn't. I mean, but that's not my point. I'm just highlighting the imperial logics that are reworked and repackaged in post-national wars and the limits of the transnational appeal of support the troops rhetoric that refuses to stick to certain states and to certain bodies. And I thought that was something that stood out for me when I was reading your text. Another thought that I had, and I, again, love to hear your comments on that, was how this discourse is affected or shifts based on how violent and bloody the war is. namely the number of casualties in combat. So I was reading the book, and something that struck me, and this could be my own fascination with dead body politics, was the relationship between the notion of supporting the troops versus mourning or grieving for troops. So in chapter 5, for example, you speak briefly about how a focus on the former, which is supporting the troops, is almost strategic as a way of distancing from the latter, as a drawing away of attention from the consequences, very real consequences of combat, right? And interestingly, in Pakistan, the move was the opposite. The commemorative practices that, you know, escalated during that time, the casualty sort of started going up. And in these theaters of mourning that were put out by the state revolved not around living troops and support for them, but more about the glorious dead. So a nation, so the impact of this in terms of how the political community is created with this idea of debt to the military is probably the same, but yet it used very different rhetoric. So I was just curious if you had any ideas on that, because you've thought about this more. And linked to this, I was wondering if this could also be a feature of how in Western liberal democracies, especially in the case of the US, dead body politics or soldier casualty becomes particularly contentious, because seeing as more troops die because of suicide rather than combat. So I was wondering if that had a possible a connection with the lack of engagement with this aspect. So again, once again, so thank you for this very timely and lucidly argued book that I believe is a brave call to resist wars and violence in our names. And it's an ethical refusal, really, to let the discourse of support to troops define what it means to belong to a political community. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Maria.
Okay, I hope everybody can hear me. Yes. Okay, good. Right, well, I'm going to start where everybody else started, which is congratulations to Kate on this really excellent book. I rather wish I'd written this one, so, we've got a mutual admiration society going on here. It is a really fantastic book, very nuanced, very sophisticated in its account of the shifts in the military contract in liberal states, specifically white imperial liberal states, that I guess has sort of been going on over about 70 years in a sense in the account that you give of it. And that there's actually a really fascinating historicization of this transition. It shifts our gaze from focusing on the kind of inside-outside logics through which the military is, as it were, legitimated and justified, to thinking more about the internal relations of solidarity through which, the liberal political community is reinforced and understood. And I think, as we've already heard, really, the way that Kate unpicks the support the troops discourse as a mode of legitimation is extremely powerful and persuasive, and that trap that we were talking about just now, in which it's almost impossible to get yourself out of it without somehow banishing yourself from the conversation, is really, very beautifully explained. It's incredibly well researched, and again, Chris has mentioned this as well. I mean, the range of statements on which Kate is drawing is really huge. The universe of texts and that she draws on is massive. And one of the things that I found very interesting in her analysis of this discourse was the way in which it's very centrally about what at one point she calls an evolving detachment of war and violence from martial discourses, ideals, and military services. So it's this very strange, paradoxical thing, which is a mode of managing liberalism's paradoxical relationship to violence, that actually, although it's all about supporting the troops, it's actually not all about war and violence. And that, I think, brings us to Maria's points about You know, the dead bodies are just not there, or they're only there extremely selectively. There's a very interesting discussion of what being the troops actually means, not just the history of how it sort of emerges. And you know, I'm going to rush over it here, but the three sort of elements are kind of indeterminacy, you know, in that it's difficult to pin down exactly what or who the troops are. An association with vulnerability, which is, I think, again, one of the really fascinating themes in the text, that part of the point of the support the troops discourse is that the troops are vulnerable. They need protecting. But also a kind of odd inclusivity in which the troops are able to be not just white cisgendered men, but actually to include a whole range of different people. So I was really interested in that, you know, that category and how it holds and how it keeps all these different sort of elements to it. So there's a, you know, there's an amazing amount of stuff here that is incredibly interesting. And the other thing that I think is really important in Kate's discussion is how she points to the way that it's still very much a particular kind of racialized and gendered logic that sort of underpins all of this, but in this complicated architecture that somehow means that's much harder to see than it may have been to see with a more traditional understanding of how the military contract works in liberal states. So basically there's, you know, fantastic stuff in here. It's incredibly interesting all the way through. I'm just going to say a few things that I think it might be interesting for us to discuss. I suppose one of the things that really I wanted to think more about was the relationship between the military, the liberal military contract of the support the troops kind, and the old version, and the extent to which this new support the troops version is nevertheless in some ways dependent on the old version. And I was thinking about the invasion of Ukraine last year and how there's this incredibly gendered thing, women and children must flee, men must fight, wouldn't let, you know, young men out, they had to go and often kill people. But the coverage of that in Western media didn't question that at all. In spite of quite long-standing arguments about how, you know, the British Army is really modern because it's got women in it and stuff like that, you know, it really didn't seem to, you know, raise any questions, which sort of suggests that the old contract is quite close to the surface in some way. So I'm interested in your thoughts on the relationships between the two. And the other thing, I think, a bit like with Chris's comments that really interests me, was this question about how do you argue against war or position yourself against war in this context of the support the troops discourse. It did occur to me that a thinker who I'm generally extremely critical of, Jeff McMahon, a sort of moral, the just war theorist, but one of the things he says, and he's trying to be very consistently liberal here, is that members of liberal militaries shouldn't fight unjust wars, and they have an obligation to say no when they're told to go off and fight an unjust war. So it's quite interesting that actually within a sort of fairly mainstream liberal discourse, there's actually one sort of pathway that is being explored. You dismiss pacifism quite quickly, and that interests me as well, because I think, you know, there is increasingly in the critical literatures that I read an assumption that pacifism is white, and I'm kind of interested in exploring that and whether that is necessarily the case or contingently the case and quite where that sort of leaves us. And that I mean, I suppose I would always want to suggest that wherever you get organized violence, you have some kind of gendered and racialized contract at work. So I am somewhat suspicious of the idea of legitimate violence from the goodies as opposed to, you know, bad violence from the baddies. So I wanted to push you a bit really on that side of things. But I also was intrigued by the abolitionism. It's very, very quick at the end. But it does seem to me that, you know, I think McMahon's idea that in liberal militaries, if you're told to fight an unjust war, you should say no, actually does pull the brick out from the military as an institution. So in some ways it is an abolitionist discourse. So I'm kind of, I suppose, intrigued by the extension of abolitionist discourse to the military and quite what that means. And I'd also like to hear more in relation to Chris's question on how this relates to other institutions within the liberal state as well. But thank you for a really, wonderful and very stimulating book.
Thank you so much, Kim, Chris, Maria, for those really provocative comments. And I'm going to open it up to the floor in just a moment, and I'll give Kate a chance to respond to some of these comments also. I also wanted to just abuse my chair's privileges very, very, very quickly to ask or pose another question, which you don't have to engage with, but just something that I was particularly kind of compelled by both in the book and in this discussion, I think coming, which unsurprisingly maybe relates to this trap of anti-war politics and picking up on some of the threads that Maria and Kim and Chris raised. There are like many threads to pick up on, but I guess many of the kind of leftist communities, anti-war communities that I guess I'm most familiar with come from more abolitionist kind of anarcho traditions within which there is no sense of solidarity with the troops. There's and I know a lot of this is in the book, but just for the benefit of the conversation, I suppose, that perceives the troops as architects of state violence, frames alongside the police, as Chris mentioned, border force, et cetera, as kind of foot soldiers of different forms of state violence and frames civilians as adversaries resistance movements in opposition to the state. And I guess for me, this comes into slight tension with another tradition of scholarship that situates the state, or kind of more state society tradition, I suppose, that situates the state as constituted by everybody. Like all of us are participating in making the state, reifying the state, holding up the state every day in everything we do. And so I guess I'm curious from you whether you do see possibilities for expressions of solidarity with the human beings that are sent to fight, with all of the people that kind of make up this effectively kind of brutal violence of the state in everyday life, or whether you see resistance as being kind of constituted by pure opposition, by a kind of binary between who constitutes the state and who constitutes not the state. So. I will leave that on the table, and I'm not going to give Kate a chance to reply yet. I'll let her collect some of her comments. I'd love to take questions from the audience. If there are, please raise your hand. We'll take a few at a time. If there are students in the room, I would love to hear from you first. PhD students, undergrad students, master's students. Yeah, let me take over here, and then is this a student in maybe here, and then I'll come for another round. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, I also don't have my glasses, so I can't see anybody, so on the right here.
Thank you. Thank you for launching the book, like a big congratulations. So my name's Hong Lee, I'm from IR department, and so my question is, when we are taught about the famous post-structuralism, and one of the challenge, or like the weakness of doing such approach is that it does not really lead us to a solution. So, sorry for asking that. So when we realize the discourse of supporting the troops is constructed by liberal military community, in that sense, what kind of implications for the anti-war activists? How is it possible for us to deconstruct such a discourse if we don't want the war to happen? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, hi, I'm Ash, and congratulations, Professor Miller, for your book. I'm a master's student in the IR department. My question, I think I have like two related questions. So the support the troop discourse is strengthened by pop culture, and especially like movies, and when the national leaders are themselves produced as icons on popular magazines like Man of the Year and thing. And that is how it reaches to the masses. So it's like, how do we immune ourselves from being socialized by these discourses, because the power here is just flowing in capillaries. And also we run the risk of being labeled as anti-national or anti-patriotic if we do not support the troops. So how do we decouple these two things?
Yeah. Thank you. One more question and then we'll turn it to Kate. Go ahead.
Working? Yes. I respect that you've bounded the discussion very firmly, but I'm also raging inside myself about that very fact. And the idea is in my mind is that a lot of one of the main reasons that the Vietnam War ended was the opposition to it from inside the military, the American military, in Vietnam. Right now, in the Middle East, the opposition to Netanyahu and the Israeli state is coming from inside the Israeli military. Now, you know, those are incredibly powerful facts, and I really want to push you to incorporate those two things into your discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm gonna turn to Kate. Do you want to give a few, you can pick maybe like two or three of these many comments to respond to, and then we can open up a little bit more?
Yes, so thank you, friends, so much for the very kind comments and for the very kind questions and for your attention. If I do not get to your question immediately, this is definitely not because I couldn't think of an answer in the last 30 seconds. I'm actually gonna start with the last question, which I really appreciate, which is a version of a question that comes up a lot in the context of this project, though not usually in that form, which I like very much, which is that I don't really talk about the views or perspectives of serving military personnel or indeed veterans very much in the book. That was an analytical choice, though it's also, I suppose, to some degree a normative and political one, and one that you may have questions about, that follows from basically the way I have set out that I see the discourses working, right? Which is that politics can be justified on behalf of the troops as long as you support the troops, you can engage in politics, you can call for the war to end as long as you do so in the service of protecting and caring for the troops, right? There's this recursive return to the troops as the central sort of moral referent of war. And I think that one of the things that's very interesting, but it also points to why some of the sort of activism that you're just speaking about can be quite powerful, right? When we think about the activism of former military veterans, of serving military personnel, and indeed something that's been very common in the US and UK throughout the 20th century, the activism of families and loved ones of deployed service members, right? We find that typically to be very politically and affectively powerful form of dissent, usually for two related reasons, and they're both that the people involved have made a greater commitment to the state and to the war than others, right? And so the people who have served in the military, we often think, have basically earned the right to speak about war and violence by virtue of that service. We think that the loved ones, particularly in a very gendered way that I think you can fill in the blanks, very often, though not only, the mothers of tragically deceased military personnel are often very effective anti-war and peace activists, right? And the reason that I don't talk about this in great detail in the book, because while those perspectives are, I think, incredibly important, right, and I would never want to underplay or delegitimize, right, both the trauma and import and very seriousness of those experiences, nor the right of anyone in any of those positions to hold political opinions on the war, broader politics, or really anything at all, that if we consistently turn to people with more immediate military service or war contact to authorize or to rely upon for our resistance and dissent against war,
oddly, we end up back in this really strange place where we end up reiterating the idea that a good citizen is someone who participates in normative violence for the state. And that if you haven't done that now, actually, in a very odd way, it's your duty to not participate in democratic discourse about war and violence because you haven't earned it. And emotionally, the idea that this is a particularly earned form of dissent feels right, but it also contradicts things that you're very familiar with from your work or from policy studies, right? That's not how the very bedrock, to return to a liberal principle, idea of, among other things, the democratic and political control of the armed forces is meant to work. But we don't tend to see it that way. And so that's why, even though in my anecdotal experience, in speaking to friends and colleagues who are in the armed forces or have served in the armed forces, broadly speaking, since people in the military are just as diverse as people outside the military, people have a great many opinions on how they personally feel about and relate to ideas of supporting the troops, right? Some find it to be affirming, many find it to be a social imposition, mildly embarrassing, an affront to professionalism, and in unfortunately very bad cases, putting people in a position of being thanked for what were often very negative experiences and being thanked by strangers in public for things that they did not enjoy that had happened to them. And I think that hopefully sort of gets this idea about like, what do we do about people who are currently in the armed forces or veterans or who are the loved ones, right? In whatever sort of kinship format of people who have been or are in the armed forces. I think that it is possible, I try to make the case in the book, though it's not easy, that certainly I hope we can work towards a politics of violence and ask at least some questions about what it would mean to abolish the military without the corresponding implication that that means treating military personnel or veterans callously or cruelly or casting them out or disregarding the suffering of themselves and their loved ones. And I think those two things can go together. My main contention is the book is that that should be part of a broader picture about contesting liberal complicities in violence rather than the center and sort of the criteria upon which we make those moral decisions. Does that make sense? All right. That doesn't answer all the questions. We got some of them.
You actually did a very artful job of pulling together a lot of different threads people asked in one answer. So thank you. Before I go to the rest of the panel, I just want to give the other audience members a chance to put some questions on the table. So I see one hand in the back, I see one hand here, and I see one hand here. So let's go in that order.
Hello, I'm Sudarshan from the Department School of Public Policy here. My question is, it might be a bit sweeping, but if we say compare the discourse on support the troops with say the discourse on support the labor in erstwhile socialist countries or something like that, how do we relate the issue of gradual hollowing of the identity of the troops and the labor over time with the abolitionist discourse? So in today's world, the unionized blue-collar labor is now being replaced by the contractual labor, and the identity of the labor no longer exists. So in that similar line, as proper troop lines are contracted out, privatized in sort of, say, Wagner Group or something like that, where there is no soldier identity remaining as such to support, per se, how does the society reconcile with that, and how far would the abolitionist discourse relate to that, if it makes any sense?
I think the second question is here, and then a couple at the back.
Thank you. My name is Manfredi from the Department of IR. I've got two questions, actually. So the first one is if you could speak a bit more about the historical development of seeing the military as passive. Do you think that the sort of fragmentation of the US foreign policy consensus that happened during the Vietnam War could have contributed to that phenomenon? And the second question is that you mentioned towards the beginning that you were influenced by the media you saw during the war years to write this book. and that obviously that media influences creating and helps create these discourses. It seems to me that new media may have changed that. I mean, a military that has to recruit through TikTok seems to me a lot less sacred as an institution than as an institution that the one portrayed by Hollywood. Do you think that this might be a shift, that there might be a shift in the direction of these discourses and how the relationship within troops and civilians is developing thanks to this change in media? And of course, thank you for the talk.
Hello, thank you for your interesting insights. I'm Aradhana and I'm from the Department of IR. So my question was on about how this discourse on support the troops can kind of, does it kind of help obscure the exploitation and kind of inequalities that the military uses against its own personnel? For and kind of any kind of criticism of that is kind of viewed as a criticism of military as a whole, and then again, you know, you're being anti-national, anti, and you kind of move away from supporting the troops.
And then one more question here, and then we'll turn back to the panel, I think.
Hi, thank you for a very interesting conversation so far. Koens Lotmakers from City University. I just wondered whether there is a precondition to all of this in terms of the discourse about these wars themselves. Like, I was at Montreal, as probably many of you were, listening to a talk from Megan McKenzie. It was looking at the visual politics of the Iraq War and how it was presented in photography, where it actually the war became absent from the pictures. So that we're talking about these wars, they have war almost, so it's, it becomes something that is rather than something that's being done. And I wonder if it, if war becomes something that is that a precondition for these kind of narratives to then shift as the troops no longer being an agent who do war, but rather war is being done to them? Now, I wonder, because that, that seems to be a very particular discourse about those wars which were deemed already as seen as illegitimate. In contrast to, for example, if you look at the pictures about Ukraine war, war is something, is yet again something that's being done in all of these visuals and these pictures, and therefore the discourse again changes because we need a perpetrator, we need a bad guy, whilst in these wars we can't have a bad guy because we are the bad guy.
Shall I turn back, to you, and then I'll let everybody else, if anybody else wants to kind of reflect on anything that's been said so far, I'll give the other panelists a chance, and then we'll have time, I think, for a couple more rounds of questions from the audience.
Yeah, thank you all so much for such great questions. Let's see if I can try and answer, frame up a couple together. I think, again, to start with the last one, to what degree is supporting the troops discourse and this like vanishing of war specific to the global war on terror? In the book, I make the probably quite unsatisfying argument that it both is and isn't, right? Like, to the extent that the war on terror is a liberal war, like it has these characteristics, and a liberal war really importantly without conscription. If a state, a liberal democracy with conscription is fighting one of these wars, basically none of this pertains, right? The structural scope conditions are wrong. And so, like, there are specific characteristics where you get sort of, Manfredi, as you were saying, like, this really interesting convergence where the global war on terror, especially the invasion of Iraq, is really highly mediatized in, like, a really specific way, right? Where we get this confluence that I don't know we would quite see again of embedded journalism, which gives the U.S. Military establishment quite a high degree of control over the images and stories that the public in the U.S., and because of how international media works, the U.K., are receiving, right? And at the same time, it's a social media facilitated war in that the soldiers who were deployed abroad are able to use Facebook, chat, Skype was a really big feature of military telecommunications during the early years of the global war on terror. And so you get this really interesting disjuncture of like a macro somewhat vanishing, not, it's never perfect, right, of course, but a somewhat vanishing or disengagement, not so much from like war and violence, but really specifically, Susan Carruthers has a great book documenting this, really specifically images of violent harms done to civilians, right? That, and as Maria mentioned, the bodies of injured coalition soldiers are the two things that stop showing up, right? The sort of, forgive me, cool technologies of violence actually still show up in the media quite a lot. And at the same time, you get the ability of like everyday military personnel to not only communicate with home, but also have their stories picked up by the embedded journalists, as well as by people doing journalism on the war from the US, UK, elsewhere, that enables them to turn, to sort of generate quite a high degree of, you might remember this if you were paying attention to politics this time, like quite cute human interest stories about what people, particularly on bases, were doing with their free time, how they were like keeping up with their kids, who was walking their dog. You might remember, you can still see it, there's a genre of videos on YouTube where people film military personnel coming home from deployment and put it up for what Lisa Silvestri, Nicola Wagner, and others have pointed out as like this really cathartic affective investment, right, in both heterosexual, usually, not always, but usually family, and sort of military solidarity. Which I think, Chris, maybe gets a little bit to your idea about how does desire come into this, which is less this idea that the troops are like sexy per se, but weirdly more that they are comforting in more of a family register, right? A member of the family to be cared for, than necessarily someone you want to find on a dating app. Like, it's the time in the erotics of supporting the troops is now making me feel uncomfortable. But like, I think off the top of my head, broadly, that's how I think that works. And in terms of the question at the back, in terms of, I'm not totally sure I caught it, but if I understand, it's about how does this idea of supporting the troops sort of sit in conversations with other forms of like structural transformations that are, seem to be creating and disenfranchising particular sort of collective groups at the same time. It's a really good question. I actually compare the troops to the idea, not the substance, but how they work politically to the idea of the working class in the book. Really highly inspired by the work of, among others, Marxist scholar Jody Dean. And so that question, I think, is really apt. And one of the things I suggest towards the end of the book, inspired by some work by critical military geographers, particularly Deborah Cohen, is to point out that in sort of trying to link the ideas of labor and soldiering, that in a lot, particularly the US, but it's happening in the UK, it has happened in Canada, you can see it in Australia, and again elsewhere, but I want to stick to the cases I can speak about with authority and empirical detail. You see this interesting thing where when soldiers and the troops are sort of elevated as this paragon of what some Catherine Lutz has sometimes called like super citizens, right? We don't all have to serve anymore, so we owe something really specific, right, and extra to those who do. And so this is the idea that people who have served in the armed forces require special and extra education, healthcare, social services, and so forth, right? Which is not an idea I'm contesting per se, but Deborah Cohen, among others, have pointed out that this investment in social services for military personnel and veterans has existed alongside, in a lot of these places, austerity. And so it plays into a really racialized and classed understanding of deservingness and who is a deserving citizen of things that either in the past or just aspirationally, we would have thought were a component of citizenship in a welfare state, like access to healthcare, like access to education, like access to mental health supports, and so forth. And so I think it's really wise and apt to work to read those together. And I will now I'm eager to hear the thoughts of other people on the panel, including around some of these ideas about abolition and solidarity, but of course on anything you might like to reflect on.
Yeah, shall we go, I don't mind, Chris, do you want to kick off or shall we? Yeah, go ahead. And then, yeah, anything you wanna pick up on, and then we can go to the audience again, thank
Thanks. Yeah, just briefly, I guess in the acknowledgements, Kate, you very kindly thank me for changing your mind about pacifism. So I feel like I should say something about pacifism, but maybe sort of the opposite of what I'm then supposed to, because I think there are powerful and important critiques of pacifism, and in that context, not all pacifisms, but kind of what we can call actually existing pacifism, pacifism as it's practiced by avowed pacifists, where the critique is in the disavowal of certain forms of violence or the avowal of certain forms of peace, other forms of violence are occluded or masked, right? That's, I think, an important critique of a lot of pacifisms, right? And the book's actually a really great kind of version of that critique, right? When you look at a lot of anti-war politics, like a lot of the quotes from anti-war politics comes from people who would happily self-describe themselves as pacifists. And you're saying even as they make anti-war articulations, they are at some level reproducing liberal violence, right? So there's a kind of critique of the ways that violence can be latent even in avowed pacifists and harder to identify and note because it's in the mouth of a pacifist. Right, so I think the book is kind of a version of critiques of pacifism that are really important. But I also think, I mean, like Kim's work on pacifisms, beyond that, I've found really powerful. And I think where the book gets to in the sense of what you call the politicization of all violence and the dismantling of state institutions, the institutions of state violence, not just militaries, but the other institutions of state violence, like I recognize a pacifism in that. Like, it's not some pacifisms, but like that as a kind of anti-militarist or abolitionist pacifism kind of has a certain amount of coherence. And so the space for thinking within the register of pacifism might be more capacious.
Yeah. Maria. Yeah?
Do you want to say something?
So the point about sacralization and the kind of greater difficulty of kind of treating the armed forces as sort of sacred objects, I think is interesting, because the odd thing about support the troops is that it's both a very domesticating discourse, and yet in some ways it still keeps that potential for sacralization there, I think. You know, thinking of things like bringing the coffins back and parading them through the street at a wooden basset or whatever. So it takes me back to that point about the quite narrow line between more classical modes of legitimating and thinking about the military and the specificity of the support the troops discourse, and how maybe there's some interplay between those that is ongoing. But I'm kind of interested in how it does do both those things, because I think you bring out very well this kind of domestication, the vulnerability, the point as well about war being something that's being done, you know, to us, and, you know, we can't be the bad guys doing, you know, all of that, I think, you know, you bring out really, really well. And the idea of the troops as vulnerable, as needing care. But there still is this echo of an older discourse there. So I'm intrigued by the interrelationship of these things.
Yeah, I just want to go back to the question that I think in many ways one of the questions is about how do you walk away from support, and how that can then label you as anti-national, and I think that's something we all struggle with, right? Because that's because the resistance to it is bound up in it seems almost impossible, even if, because in my work, one of the critiques that I've had to face is that sometimes it is suggested that I've humanized the military soldier, and therefore, whereas I, you know, in my work, I'm very clear on what my politics is, and yet, sometimes I get it from both sides, right? So there is this question of, in talking about the vulnerability of what war does to families and soldiers, you humanize them, and you're actually asking for more empathy and support, and in that way, you are you know, feeding into this narrative, and yet I am trying to do the opposite. So I wonder, maybe one of the ways out of this dilemma is to actually, you know, unpack what support means and why it's needed. And so building a different picture of the troops or slash soldier, which is in your work very distinct, but you know, how can we build a different picture where we can really talk about why is support needed? What does war do to families? What does war do to people? And what kind of support is? So I think just turning the discourse around on its head and just sort of challenging, saying that, you know, what does support mean? And in the whys of it, I think the critique of war can also come out. So again, it sounds a little fuzzy right now, but I think there's something to be had in this discussion in terms of just unpacking this and seeing where it leads us and trusting that. Because I think for me to not talk about the soldier, and I think you end with that also, that this does not mean this. And this caveat you have to always do, otherwise, you know, I don't think you're understood, not because of any sort of fear of backlash, but because I think the message is, for me, it's incomplete. So yeah, just wanted to add to that. Yeah,
I think that's super smart, Maria, and really gets it. A lot of the questions I was kind of running through in my head as we were talking, so thank you for sharing that. Let's take one more round of questions. Henri, and then here in the middle, and then here on the end. Go ahead.
Great, thanks. Henri, independent researcher, I guess. thanks, Kate, for the book. I'm really looking forward to reading it. It's a bit of a tangential question, but I was wondering if you want to reflect a bit on how to sort of support the troops, which is about supporting an institution that's imagined to be masculine, how that is similar to and different from like the campaigns to support nurses, to support the NHS, which is a sort of space that or institution that's gendered feminine, and what are the class politics of that, et cetera. Thanks.
Yeah, it's not on, I think. We have another one just here.
Thank you so much. I have a question about a kind of feminist response to the ongoing war in Ukraine. The response to me seems to me is very, very contradictory, and I'm so stuck with it so deeply. So I'd like to throw it to you all, and I want to hear about your thoughts. The thing is, I happened to see a blog written by some feminists from Ukraine last year, and with, in which they are campaigning for the military aid, the weapons and arms from the Western countries, particularly from NATO. And I was quite surprised by the language they use, like to them, the war is or the weapons are tools to like save the one they love and like to save their home, and so it seems to me like the morality of the ends can be separated from the, you know, the means, and I was also surprised by like because they are feminists, and some of them like had organized events to help victims of domestic violence from, you know, the 2014 Russia-Ukrainian war. So they are more aware of the, you know, the gendered consequence of war and of the militarization, like compared with normal people, other people. So yeah, I was super surprised. And I'd like to know like how to address this contradiction. Oh, and by the way, I had an opportunity on the International Women's Day to talk some of the Ukrainian feminists in person, and that day they gave a lecture on what's going on there. They give some details about now there is a like gendered division of labor, like for women now in Ukraine, it's more difficult to get like highly paid job than before, because this kind of job are exclusively occupied by men. So I just ask them, like, since they have decided to campaign for the military aid, so ask them, like, what are you going to do to undo the gendered consequence, the effect? And their answers were quite emotional, like with my home, my parents, under the bombing and the shelling of Russia, I will like take any weapons from whoever is willing to provide that aid. So yeah, I just want to know how to address this dilemma, like from a feminist pacifist perspective. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Just two really easy questions to finish with, Kate. We'll take one more.
Now Ansel's going to ask me to solve world peace.
Hello. Yeah, so my name is Ansel. I'm from the IR department. Thank you very much for this very insightful discussion and the great book. So my question was about the role of this discourse around supporting the troops beyond, in liberal democracies, beyond the Anglo-American sphere, and especially where this discourse might not be that prevalent or maybe even turned on its head. So I was specifically thinking about Germany, where there arguably is even a lack of support for the troops, where service personnel returning from Afghanistan, for example, was criticizing that there was actually, the support was actually lacking. And of course, there's a big historical component in there. But I was wondering to what degree there might be countries where not supporting the troops is actually important for creating a political community. And this might even go then beyond liberal democracies, where when you think of military dictatorships, so where the military is deployed within a country, where again, not supporting the troops is important to create a political community and indeed resistance to that military.
Thank you. So, Kate, I'll give you like 1 minute to respond to those questions and then a few minutes to wrap up, but we'll see if anybody else wants to come in before you.
Yes, thank you all for the great questions. Ansel, thank you for busting me on not giving the scope conditions of my argument at the beginning of the talk. Those are such good points. I think broadly I'll say that, and hopefully I actually say this in the book, I'm pretty careful about suggesting this argument mostly pertains to liberal democracies with professional armed forces. That's the set of cases that I think this pertains to. And I also point out that this specific language, like supporting the troops as like a phrase or a particular way of phrasing the normative relationship between society and the military, it is linguistically specific. There's a reason it shows up in Anglo states that do a lot of military operations with the US. But that the problem of what happens when we don't have conscription anymore, but we are serving and we have some notion of civilians as existing in some kind of normative relationship, possibly of obligation to the military, that kind of still exists to be solved. And you are, I would argue to you, starting to see that in Germany just a little bit now that conscription is no longer policy. And you're totally right that in states, in dictatorships, instances of conscription not supporting the troops can be also really important to solidaristic politics. Henry, I think you're right. Supporting the troops and supporting the nurses in the NHS during the pandemic have like a really similar logic. And while I have much more sympathy for the NHS than I do for the global war on terror, it's worth noting how they have the two things in common, right? One, that it's super depoliticizing, right? So the pandemic and the overwork of the NHS and the vulnerability and sacrifices that NHS workers were sort of like being called upon to make, but also were structurally being compelled to make by the conditions of work within the NHS, right? That's not dissimilar to the terms of military service, nor is the idea that we see the nurses are on strike now, solidarity, that claps don't pay the bills, which is a way that veterans groups have used support the troops discourses to make claims on the US and UK states following their return. And this has not been a minute, but really finally, this idea of feminist responses to Ukraine, I think, first of all, I'm gonna flag
that there are a ton of feminists from Ukraine who I really like that you pointed out are the voices we should be centering in discussing and thinking about that. And also in pointing out that because of these scope conditions, this isn't an argument that is a template to move to every war, though I like that it maybe has some traction on helping us think about things. And that I think sort of as Kim was thinking about Ukraine earlier, it's an instance of what I was thinking about in this discussion of the perils and promises of pacifism, or we should probably say pacifisms, just like we should say feminisms, that in my mind, one of the things thinking about a politics of violence might help us do is avoid prejudged absolutist investments that we see coming preloaded from a particular ideological or political position without thinking about those in terms of ongoing harms and relationships of not only solidarity, but also complicity. Anyway, we'll leave that there.
Does anybody else on the panel want to jump in with any last concluding thoughts? Okay, in that case, Kate, I know you wanted a couple of minutes at the end to wrap up and say a few words, so I will pass it back to you.
Yes, indeed. So apologies, I just finished talking. I believe we're going to go for drinks.
We are, and I will.
But before you do that, you have to listen to me thank some people. First and foremost, obviously, of course, thank you to the panelists for this kind and generous conversation. This is like, when you write your books, you already know that like having people read it really carefully and then talk about it with you is like your dream outcome. And so this has been really lovely. I also, of course, want to thank Millie for chairing, as well as Katie for so expertly and empathetically coordinating this event. I also want to thank a decent number of you are or have been my students. You are not the sum total of people I have ever had the pleasure to stand in front of while doing public speaking. But I'm immensely grateful to you and to my past students for the support and encouragement as I worked on it, like variations of this project, and more recently for your empathy and solidarity in the context of what I know was really disruptive, but to us very important industrial action about the future of the university. I also need to thank my colleagues here and elsewhere who read like a million versions of this manuscript. Many of them are here. They're also thanked exhaustively in the acknowledgments. I also need to thank the OUP editorial team, Laura Schoberg and Ann Tickner, and my PhD supervisor, Professor Elizabeth Fraser, who of Oxford, who believed in this project at a time when everyone else thought it was obvious, uninteresting, apolitical, boring, and so forth. And who gave me a place to stay and write and figure out how to explain at least why I thought the politics of supporting the troops really matters, and that means a very great deal to me. I'm also going to thank my partner Chris, who is in attendance this evening. And though they are not here, someone tell them later. I need to thank my sister, Carrie, and my parents, Lauren and Meg, because if you are an academic, you know that genuinely nothing is possible without some pretty big support. So I need to thank them as well. It was a very big team effort. And of course, thank you very much to yourselves for attending this event and for lending us your ears and for your interest, I hope, continually, in feminist and post-structural takes on militarism and martiality.
Thank you so much, Kate. And I just want to, again, echo Kate's thanks and extend a massive congratulations to her for this really extraordinary book, which my technological skills are now failing me. And Katie, how do I do? I'm really obviously a great lecturer who knows how to use.
All right, my students are very familiar with how this goes.
So in a moment, there's going to be a QR code that comes up on the screen. And if there isn't, then you can Google Kate's book and buy it from Oxford University Press should you wish to. Should you have institutional resources to do so, please encourage your libraries to buy it if they haven't already. And otherwise, you can read more about Kate's work through our library copy of the book if you're a student or a faculty member here. I really sincerely recommend it. The comments and the conversation today has just been just a kind of almost like a tiny window into the extraordinary richness of what's in the very large and very rigorous and thought-provoking reflections here. So thank you so much all for coming. Thank you to the panelists, and just to take a moment to thank Kate and congratulate her on this really amazing accomplishment. So